You are listening to Devil We Know, a true crime podcast, which may contain adult themes, explicit language, and graphic depictions of violence. Portions of this show may be traumatic for those under 18. Listener discretion is advised.
In this episode of Devil We Know, two maximum security prisoners plot their departure using their twisted minds and the people in their way as tools for escape. The dark corners of our world, of our minds, of our lives, are always tucked away behind unopenable doors, or so we assume. One of those unopenable doors, one where we hide our nation's killers, is a door tucked away in the Adirondack region of upstate New York. This region, known to some as North Country, has been home to a hardened people, a hardened terrain, and even a harder past. The first peoples to arrive in the Adirondacks between 9,000 and 17,000 years ago came southward from the St. Lawrence River Valley following the last ice age. This boreal forest land, full of mountains and lakes carved out by ancient glaciers, was untamed and unforgiven to the first peoples there. Eventually, though, there were roots placed in these spruce-covered highlands, and many settlements all competed for the game that the area had to offer. Later named the Hunting Grounds by English cartographers. This place was known to indigenous peoples as a bowl with one spoon. It was clear by this assertion that there was not much opportunity for everyone to live with plenty. And when smallpox, conversion, and other European violences were brought from overseas, suddenly the place was bare, thought to be a complete wasteland. Thomas Pownall, a colonial official and a former British governor of Massachusetts Bay, reported that many of the first peoples in the area still knew it as the Dismal Wilderness, or the Habitation of Winter. This cold wasteland, this veritable monument to peoples of a bygone era, even recently became home to numerous archaeological finds that proved the decline of population over hundreds of years previous. It was only once the newly formed state of New York claimed these uplands that the next phase of the Adirondacks' long-winded history began. The resources that they once held, however scarce, were made scarcer when deforestation of the area due to lumber contracts created a starker, harsher landscape than ever before. It was because of this that eventually a nature reserve was commissioned to protect the naturally occurring bioregion and what was left of its prospects. But its harshness for human life was never forgotten, proving home to small, hardy villages of upstate New Yorkers that have learned to tame the land to a degree. But some things can't be so easily tamed, and we hide them away in a wilderness that's so seldom visited. That aspect of human nature, the idea of hiding our greatest sins out in rural corners of our nation, is something we see apparent in the existence of the Clinton Correctional Facility. This isolated institution, found in the wintry village of Dannemora, is sometimes known as New York's Little Siberia. This nickname might evoke some of the unforgiving cold that is associated with the remote area, but it also is fitting for another reason. Like Siberia, home to the vast spaces of tundra and boreal forest alike, Clinton is large, the largest maximum security prison in the whole state of New York. Dannemora, as the prison came to be known by locals, also was home to New York's own death row, and to the state's 2008 abolition of the death penalty. Yet it was also here that many found new life. While some of these figures fade into the print as infamous serial killers, kidnappers, and rapists, there were others, like Gregory Corso, whose sentence was a meager 3 years, all because he stole a suit. Corso and many others found a way out, with even famous rapper Tupac Shakur having a short stint at Clinton for 8 months before being released on appeal. There's even the mountain air of the Adirondacks, which breathed new life into numerous tuberculosis patients who served their time at Clinton. only to find that the clean air cured them of their consumption. Whether literal freedom or simply a new lease on their life inside the prison, some were offered a light to the end of their tunnel. But to some, the 30-foot walls that stand above Dannemora's inmates prove a lasting reminder of how little prospect there is for them to see the outside world once more. To some, entering Clinton Correctional Facility may not be a literal death sentence, but they know they won't be dying free men. To them, there is no escape. In the year 2003, a man with a mind for scheming became part of the Clinton facility. David Sweat, a proven planner, was tacked for a murder charge that gave him no foreseeable future outside those 30-foot walls. This ancient prison, the third oldest in the state of New York, is where he'd be resting his head until he died. With that thought, there was another. Why not make the best of it? David wasn't known for trouble there, at the prison. In fact, his case was the opposite. He chose instead to work. At Clinton, work didn't make one free, nor did that illusion exist, because such a lie would be thoughtless and cruel. But work did make one industrious, and it did exercise an inmate's hidden talents. It was worth it to keep working for years to earn a spot on the A block, the honor block. In other words, the place where privileges of all sorts are extended to good behavior inmates. David learned, too, that through his work, he had considerable talent in a key area. He'd learned to sew, to stitch, to piece garments and fabrics together in a professional flurry. His work even drew the eyes of others, especially a woman known to the inmates informally as Tilly. Thanks to her high school days, Tilly, sharing the name of one of David's own sisters, was named Joyce Mitchell, and she and her husband Lyle worked at the prison, with Tilly serving as a seamstress for the facility's population of nearly 2,900 inmates. This labor alongside David and working inmates proved to be more than just the basis for a standard team. In fact, Tilly found comfort in David's work, and it's said that the two shared more than just glances. A flirtation to a certain degree came into the mix, and over the time that Tilly spent in the prison's tailor shop, she fostered a fascination with David to a greater degree. It was not the first time either that Tilly would have been unfaithful in her marriage. Born of a beef farmer who's well known in the region, and her time as a tax collector at Dickinson Center, a small hamlet about 60 miles west of Dannemora, showed how her own once thought of her as dutiful, unassuming, and trustworthy. She still lived in the village of Dickinson Center and was believed a fixture of the community, to a great degree relying on the skills she honed at the shoe factory in Malone, New York, to create a future for herself elsewhere, as she did, eventually at Clinton with her now husband Lyle. But before all that, she did have another marriage, a first marriage, with a man named Toby Primo. The two had been sweethearts in high school, and Toby had the highest opinion of her for a long time. Quote, "I always thought she was a beautiful, loving person," he'd say later to the New York Times, reliving the past as he labored, only to remember the way he'd suffer through their divorce, where his perspective changed. "I thought she was heartless," he'd say to the woman Tilly later became. What changed in Tilly? For one thing, Tilly had begun seeking attention from other men during her marriage to Toby. She began affairs with two separate co-workers during her five-year marriage, one of which was outed to Toby by his girlfriend. The other co-worker, with whom Tilly had made her move on, was none other than Lyle Mitchell, whom she later wed in a second marriage that resulted in Lyle adopting Toby's own son, Toby Jr., who now goes by Toby Mitchell. The overall effect of this imperfect beginning was a foundation of mistrust, and as rumor has it, Tilly was never really done with her attention-seeking, even soliciting attention from the inmates themselves in multiple cases long before David entered her field of vision and began earning his reputation on the honor block as an inmate with so-called model behavior. In fact, although suspicions arose and her seeming intimacy with prisoners began earning more notice in 2012, and it was noted by her superior that Tilly often came off like a friend to the inmates, as she often tried to sweet-talk them into getting things done her way. This wasn't all, though. The fraternization was apparently affecting the quality of work, and to that end, there were complaints leveraged. And when Tilly received a dissatisfactory evaluation, she cried harassment. The superintendent at the time sided with Tilly, and Tilly's superior, Vicki Lynn Safford, balked at the rebuke. Tilly's reputation among the workers in the prison kept climbing, But it wasn't until November of 2013 that she was finally moved to the tailoring sector, where Vicky Lynn simply stated that the production pressures of the job as well as a shortage of personnel left her no option. It was here that she would come across David, who would change her life in the years to come as he moved up in the world, so to speak, by earning his place on the honor block. It wasn't just David Sweat that made a name for himself and earned the respect of his peers and the operators of Clinton. 5 years after his arrival, another man, Richard Matt, was brought to Dannemora for a sentence of his own. Arriving in 2008, the same year that the death penalty was repealed, Ricky Matt, as he was more commonly known, was awaiting his earliest possible parole in 2032. It was a long wait, and Ricky, who was known for both his brutality and his wily behavior in and out of prison, decided to change his approach. He too began to do what he could to earn a decent reputation in the prison. There was a point at which he began doing art, which went a long way for him, as he was a self-proclaimed copy artist with a talent for faces to boot. He drew famous people, real or imagined, including President Barack Obama and Tony Soprano, the fictional TV character. He sold his art too, and displayed his other talents as he climbed into the honor block himself, eventually meeting his new neighbor, David. David Sweat, the planner, and Ricky Matt, the con man, they'd both proven fearsome killers, and to be put next to each other with only a few bars between them would prove a dangerous choice for Clinton. And yet, although they behaved so far, what could possibly happen? Ricky earned only one blemish on his record 3 years after initial imprisonment, having had possession for materials for tattooing. David, though, went a long time without a blemish whatsoever. Long enough, in fact, that the two inmates started to become regular chums on the inside. Someone else with which they were chummy, though, was Tilly, the tailor whose supervision of David became more than that when Ricky started noticing the tension there. Ricky was a man of charisma, and like David, he didn't have to imagine his effect on the ladies. As such, it didn't take much prompting for Tilly, whose track record wasn't clean either, to take an interest in Ricky, and Ricky saw it as an advantage. He began to ask for favors, like contact with his daughter, with which Tilly all too happily obliged. He made her feel special there, in that cold, unforgiving place, and it was likely a thought in her head, he's a good inmate. That must mean he's an okay guy. Wrong time, wrong place, she might have seen him as a wayward stitch in the fabric of society. Rough on the outside, but not so different from herself or others. A little magnetism between the two led to more favors, usually for things that Ricky couldn't get on the inside. Glasses with lights on them, a couple of hacksaw blades, and even a screwdriver bit. Meanwhile, the two inmates, growing in closeness, formulated a plan that could bring them closer to freedom. David wasn't long for his A-block privilege during the time that this planning began. Firstly, there was a note Tilly had heard of, that alleged a relationship between David and her. She knew, of course, that nothing had escalated so far. After all, there were only the flirtations of a workplace between them in so far, and of course, the favors. Still, David made a comment to another person, incendiary in nature, which eventually resulted in David being punished for harassment and interference. This provocation, however, occurred in September of 2014, left David unable to continue his work in the tailor shop, and even more likely, the decision also came from the note discussing his supposed relationship with Tilly. David's punishment was one that came as an emotional shock to Tilly, who'd seen him 5 days a week, hours on end, for so long now that he felt like a part of her day-to-day. And when she understood what his removal from the honor block meant, she burst into uncontrollable tears. Ricky, of course, noticed this too. It was the leverage that he needed, that the duo needed, to start making their plan a firm reality. All while seeing this increaseness in willingness from Tilly, in evaluating her reaction to David's removal, Ricky worked his allure to his advantage, toying with the idea that Tilly was in need of attention. He grabbed me and kissed me. It startled me. He kissed me with an open-mouth kiss, Tilly would later admit. When in April of 2015, Ricky took matters a step farther by initiation of an actual sex interaction. Tilly and Ricky began to pass notes. Some spoke of escape, and Tilly was sure that she believed them. She wasn't sure, however, what her part would be in all of this, until Ricky turned things up in a sexual sense. Some of those notes were of a sexual nature, but I never had any sexual contact with inmate Sweat, only inmate Matt. I did take some naked photos of my breasts and vagina and gave them to inmate Matt to give to inmate Sweat. I do not know what they did with the photos. It was clear now that Tilly was in the duo's pocket, and Ricky had made use of her attraction to both him and David. In May, only a month after the kiss he first initiated, Ricky also approached her a few more times, requesting oral sex. Tilly stated later that she performed the acts out of fear, and that Ricky would appear with a large coat that had a hole in it, where she could touch his genital. It was a perk of the honor block. After all, the inmates could wear their choice of civilian clothing, among other personal freedoms. But now that these personal freedoms, including smuggling and sexual contact, Ricky was once again crossing the lines, as he had done on the outside so many times before. It was with these boundaries being pushed that Ricky and David were able to piece together some more of their plan and to begin finding others that were willing to aid them. Ricky had found other avenues, other ways to push the boundaries that were set in this monumental prison. It was often with his innocuous talents that he would secure some of the more treacherous aid from the people around him. Ricky's artistic talent, with his current pastime, painting, wasn't lost on the working professionals at the prison, and David too became readily active in the trade. In fact, others were ready to receive the duo's work with open arms, and always at a cost. For Eugene Palmer, known as Gene, that cost amounted to supplies. The veteran correctional officer, with 27 years of work under his belt, would go shopping at Michael's, an art supply store, in order to supply Ricky and David with tools to create their artwork. Ricky and David, in exchange, would offer him their works, some of which had begun to show real value. Whether that value was also slightly sentimental remained to be seen. But Gene was willing to pay, and when it wasn't with art supplies, Gene's payment became all the more surprising and specific. That is, Gene began to supply the two men with needle-nose pliers on four occasions, also supplying them with a flathead screwdriver. Gene also was the man when David was first removed from the honor block and from being Ricky's cell neighbor. Gene stood in for David when speaking with one of the superintendents, vouching for him to continue industry work, which was agreed upon, although David now had a tailor assignment separate from that of Ricky and Tilly. This also meant that eventually David was offered his old cell block, and with some bribes, Ricky even secured David his old cell. The bribe consisted of pornographic drawings and a considerable amount of cigarettes, a well-known currency in prison. The plan was set back a little by the transition and the time it took to agree to the new terms, but still, with this special treatment and with the tools that they received from Gene, it was going to be far easier to manage the last few months of the plan they had made. It was only a matter of time, in fact, between November in 2014 to June 6th of 2015. Gene had played a crucial role in supplying Ricky and David with everything they needed for their own great escape. He had even allowed catwalk access to David, whose understanding of the prison's internal workings were greatly increased. With this access and with the tools provided, David was able to access the electrical workings to both Ricky's cell and his own. David also had chiseled out a way into a steam pipe, whose inner workings had cooled once spring came around. By May, it had cooled enough that it was safe for David to start sawing away with the hacksaw blades that Tilly had provided. It was enough, it had to be, for the use of power tools was impossible, given all the noise that they would make. Inmates at Dannemora, of course, had access to such tools, but only when working. It was a different world. This prison with knives and drills in the hands of known killers, but the ability to use something else entirely also offered them anonymity. The prison officials, whoever might notice, will not note a missing drill, because Tilly had been far more industrious bringing vats of frozen ground chuck that contained tools like hacksaws without drawing attention. At least not attention we're speaking about. Gene himself noticed the ground chuck, but to him, it was just that, beef. Nothing odd there. Everyone ate beef. And since Clinton Correctional Facility allowed employees to bypass scanners and metal detectors, what did Tilly have to lose by bringing them in? David made use of these blades to push, inch by inch, hour by hour, his way into the pipes that relieved the prison boilers of steam during the winter months. It was a daily grind that eventually led to one, then two, rectangular holes in the large pipe. Holes big enough for grown men to climb through. The pipe, finally about a story below the first entry point, now offered passage into an access tunnel designed for maintenance of said pipe. When he made his way there, it was only a matter of time until he decided which way to exit. There were a number of manholes, and of course, these would lead into a street. Could it be that the street was easily seen from the prison watchtowers? That was no longer an issue, because the watchtower nearest this underground passage had fallen into disuse. It was a money issue that the prison couldn't abide. Yet how close would they have to emerge in order to escape detection? That part remained to be seen. But what David did know, upon first observation, was that two of the three manholes accessing this passage were chained shut. David then checked the path of least resistance. In the dead of night, pulling up out of the unchained manhole to find a clearing, the doorstep of the prison's powerhouse, and even someone's residence, he decided to try his stupendous luck at one of the other two manhole covers. He approached the far end of the passage, sawing at the chain that held his chosen cover closed, and popped it open. He knew at that point he'd made the progress he wanted. He was getting out. The next few moments were a blur of furied frenzy as he covered up the manhole once more and raced back. It was now 4:15 in the morning, and his absence would be noted once the guards made their rounds. He made it back with a soiled face and a lifted spirit as he approached his once again cell neighbor, calling him by his last name. Matt, get up. David, now standing in his cell, carried a cigar in his mouth for celebration, a code between them for when Ricky stood and saw the cigar, the dastardly grin on David's gaunt face. He knew they were getting out. Soon, the last leg of their plan was in motion, and David arranged for a punctual getaway driver. He arranged by note to bring on Tilly, who still worked with Ricky. The note passed hands, and when the working day started, Tilly would be able to receive the note and know her final role in the duo's long, arduous escape plan. She would be the driver. In fact, she had an idea of her own regarding where she'd go. What she'd do. Would she take them all the way to Mexico? She could stay there with them, then, and forget the tedium of her prison-bound life. She even admitted to Ricky that she wouldn't have said anything if David kissed her. Maybe her future, whatever it looked like, included him, and Mexico, of course. It was during the time that they were first planning their escape that the question about David gave Ricky everything he needed to know about Tilly, as he told David later. She's fucking nuts. She'll bring us whatever we want. Just tell me what you need, and I'll get her to bring it. The weeks leading up to this point were rife with opportunities to discover the plan. The superintendent and the administration of the prison contacted Building 2 during this time, from late May to early June, for permission to perform a lockdown and do a thorough search. There was reason to believe that something was amiss, and yet, Building 2, who controlled all lockdown procedures and unusual incidents, denied the request due to the overtime labor costs that would be incurred in the process. At the same time, David's mother, Pamela, was planning to get himself transferred closer to her home in Conklin. She was keeping correspondence in the mail, and she hoped that by transferring him nearby, she'd get to visit him more often. June 6th, the night of the escape. The grand event was fully planned to the minute, even with the taunting, sometimes racist sticky notes left behind along their escape routes. David's note told Tilly to arrive at the specific manhole of his choosing at midnight on the dot. Midnight, not a minute later, not a minute sooner. It was at that time, because of David's notorious love for punctuality, that he and Ricky came topside, only to find that Tilly had not yet arrived. She would not arrive at all, in fact. Tilly, who began suffering from a fit of nerves, sought hospitalization and claimed, of all things, that she was having a panic attack. Truly, it was her nervousness about what was required of her as she ate Chinese food at a restaurant in nearby Malone. And even after receiving the note, she had recited at the last moment that she couldn't go through with it. She mustn't. Ricky and David, free though they were on their own. They had emerged from the maintenance tunnel, somewhat grimy, and they had between them a number of belongings inside a guitar case. But they were free, and soon they made way to put distance between themselves and the prison walls, which loomed high above them still. In a remote town where the vast majority of the population are inmates, about 3/4 in fact, it's strange that the two mysterious men carrying a guitar case in the middle of the night didn't seem to turn any heads. Only two witnesses in Dannemora mentioned seeing the duo after their version of the Shawshank Redemption. These witnesses, remaining nameless, saw the duo poking around, and one confronted them about being in their yard. It was then that they mentioned that they were just on the wrong street, unsure of their surroundings. A clear sign of deception and a purely telegraphed and obvious ploy to avoid suspicion as escaped convicts. One would think this would have been clear right away, but strangely, the two witnesses did not think to report the duo they saw for over 5 hours. It was as if the obvious clues had been erased from their memory until being later interviewed by local news. At 5:30 a.m., a routine checkup of all the cells caused a CO to notice David and Ricky missing. In their place was a sticky note reading, quote, "Have a nice day." Dannemora then went into lockdown, and a thorough search led to the discovery of the tunnel that had been, like Hollywood suggests, carved into the back of the cell walls to allow for escape into the pipe. They soon found the tunnel leading to the catwalks of the prison, which were 6 stories high, and eventually they discovered the last piece of the puzzle, the pipe that David had cut into to make room for himself and Ricky as they passed under the walls of the complex. The two had essentially cut through a steel wall, broken through brick, and crawled through the ruined steam pipe in order to earn their escape. The state of New York, upon discovering that two feared killers were on the loose, set out to post a reward. Anyone who had information that led to their capture, alive or dead, was going to earn the witness $100,000. But there was more work to do. The prison had to solve the issue of how these inmates were able to acquire tools that enabled them to escape. They decided to check the contractors that worked on the prison grounds to see whether any of their tools were missing. Eventually, it became clear that there were two people in the prison's own employ who aided Ricky and David, Tilly and Jean. Each one had involvement that was made clear to the authorities as they endeavored about 3 weeks to search for the two escapees. Meanwhile, a search party set out to look for the killers, the final team complete with 200 officers from multiple forces and even aerial search vehicles and bloodhounds. It had become evident on searching that the two men were making their way through the Adirondacks. This rough terrain, by trespassing on several campgrounds and even stealing a shotgun at one particular stop. When this became clear, the news began reporting the twosome as armed and dangerous. The parties were nearing David and Ricky's location at one point, and it was getting hard to decide what to do. Ricky wasn't physically fit, and David began considering him a liability, especially after he fell hard and made noise with a search party team nearby. David considered him a liability for other reasons and feared him a bit. To boot, he claimed that the two found a cabin about 30 miles west of the prison where David wanted to continue on. Ricky wanted to stay where they'd broken in, had heat, water, and alcohol. Though the importance of the order might not have necessarily been the same in Ricky's mind, Ricky suggested that they hold their ground and simply shoot or take hostages, if they must, to keep their little hideaway. Soon the two split ways. David took a northeast route, banking on crossing the border into Canada. Meanwhile, Ricky continued west. It was this decision, the decision to keep west and to hold his ground, that would prove most dangerous for Ricky. As he left the cabin, he was seen around 3:45 p.m. that day by a member of law enforcement who saw him headed into the woods outside Malone, about 10 miles from the Canadian border. He was killed in the woods there, and his freedom as an animal on the run had only lasted 20 days, June 6th to June 26th. David, however, lasted a bit longer in terms of his escape. He was shot on the 28th of June, 2 days after Ricky was killed, and David had almost made it to the Canadian border when he was brought back. He did not die of his 2 shots to the chest, but instead was questioned by investigators soon after. David was quoted laying a saying, "The Shawshank ain't got nothing on me," referencing the famous Stephen King story, Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption, which features a grand prison break with some blatant similarities to David's own plan. The same story was later turned into a movie, and the magical touch of cinematic clockwork brought the plan to life in a way that likely inspired David's own thoughts. Whatever the case, his escape too didn't last, and the end soon came to the 3-week manhunt, which cost New York taxpayers an estimated $23 million. But the story of their escape had more lasting effects on the prison. When it was sussed out, the two workers there aided in Ricky and David's escape It was also assumed that some inmates on the honor block knew of the plan as well. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, made encouraging statements to the correctional officers that made it clear. Abuse was welcomed if it meant that they could get answers out of the inmates there. So it was that the inmates left behind after Ricky and Dave's escaped endured such horrors to the point where prisoners' legal services stepped in to put up a donation fund for the prisoners at Clinton Correctional Facility. Tilly and Jean received justice of their own for their hands in the escape. Jean, for his part, received 6 months for his criminal facilitation. Tilly, though, who initially pled not guilty, but the prison seamstress called a cheater in an account by her ex-husband Toby, eventually offered the truth, and for her charges of smuggling contraband and criminal facilitation, she received a 7-year sentence. And though she was denied parole 3 times, she was eventually released conditionally from Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in February of 2020. All during her sentence, her faithful husband stood by her and even visited her every other weekend. Now that she was out, though, her eyes had turned downward in the public view. She was downcast, and her devoted husband, when catching the cameras across the street from their home, rushed to keep Tilly from being poked and prodded all the more for her choices 5 years previous. For the conditional release she received, it was likely far better that she keep her distance from the media anyway. Though she still swears to Lyle, on her own son's life, that the sexual dalliances she was said to have with Ricky during their time in Taylor's shop were simply untrue rumors. As for David, when he was caught, he was brought back by law enforcement, and he claimed that his escape was a statement. His defense, weak though the orator was, claimed that his treatment back in Dannemora was escape-worthy, that he did what he did to also aid in pointing out flaws in the prison's own system, which were also thoroughly blamed in the Inspector General's 150-page report of the escape.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. First, I would note that unlike Mrs. Mitchell and Mr. Palmer, my client has taken full responsibility for his actions. That at Mrs. Mitchell's sentencing, she showed very little remorse. And it should be noted that Mr. Palmer is still denying all responsibility for his role in the prison escape. But Mr. Sweat has taken the full responsibility by pleading guilty to the entire indictment. And that is all 3 counts that were lodged against him. Secondly, I would note that Mr. Sweat has cooperated with the IGs, the Inspector General's office. He's provided very useful information to the Inspector General's office, and that should be noted for the record. Mr. Sweat, he will continue to cooperate with the IG's office if the cooperation is still needed. It should also be noted for the record that after Mr. Sweat was shot, he spoke with law enforcement agents while he was in Albany Medical Center. And Mr. Sweat revealed to those agents that there's a point in a time when Mr. Sweat and Mr. Matt were on the lam, and Mr. Matt threatened to take hostages, to kidnap people, and to kill people. And it was Mr. Sweat who talked down Mr. Matt from doing that. So I would say that Mr. Sweat saved some lives. There's another occasion when Mr. Sweat and Mr. Matt were on the lam, and Mr. Sweat, Mr. Matt, he had a shotgun. He pointed the shotgun at a law enforcement official, and Mr. Matt was going to shoot that official, but Mr. Sweat stopped him from doing that. So that should be noted for the record. As far as any fines, as far as any surcharges, as far as any restitution, we would object. And the reason is that Mr. Sweat is serving 6 years in the special housing unit, the SHU. And while he's in the SHU, he does not receive any commissary whatsoever. Once he is eligible to get out of the SHU, in 6 years, Mr. Sweat will be eligible for what's called grade 3 work. And it's my understanding, based upon the rules and regulations of the Department of Corrections, that a grade 3 work gives Mr. Sweat $6 per week. And it's my further understanding, based upon Department of Corrections rules and regulations, that a 20% of that salary, so to speak, will be taken out of the $6 per week and applied to any order of restitution or fines and surcharges. So that is $1.20 per week that will be applied to any order of restitution. So this will not be paid off. I did the math, but it's 1,029 years. So, Mr. Sweat, he has no resources whatsoever, and Mrs. Mitchell, she has a pension, and then Mr. Palmer, I believe he'll be eligible for Social Security, and he'll have a pension of his own. So I believe that the order of restitution is a better placed on Mrs. Mitchell and Mr. Palmer. And lastly, what I would note is I have spoken to my client. He is remorseful. He does apologize for his role in the prison escape. He apologizes for the trauma and for the fear that he put on the state of New York and the county of Clinton.
That said, even though there was an increase of casual and harsh abuse of Ricky and David's honor block neighbors after the fact, the defense regarding said abuse toward David didn't retain water in the eyes of the court. Additionally, the court refused to let David retract his plea after making an apology to the community, which was an additional ploy to learn some leniency for the acts David had taken.
Mr. Sweat may want to say some words.
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to apologize to the community and the people who felt the fear and felt it necessary to, leave their homes or their community because of the escape. That was never my intent, and I deeply apologize for that, Your Honor.
After that apology, though, the court made its decision clear, and it called to attention the number of stupid choices made by David and by Ricky, and called David to live with his consequences as a result.
The court has read the pre-sentence report, and I thank the Seneca County Probation Department as well as the Seneca County Probation Department for putting together a report that gives some insight, I believe, into this situation. For approximately a month or so, this community was in turmoil. A number of people were exposed to danger. The officers and correction officers were placed in harm's way because of Mr. Sweat's act. It's evident to me from reading the report that Mr. Sweat is not stupid. He's intelligent, articulate, and understands what has happened to him and what he's done. He has, however, made stupid choices. Beginning very early in his life, from 1993 to present, one of his more stupid decisions was got him convicted for murder in 2002. For whatever reason, other than stupid decisions made in January of 2015, when he joined forces with Mr. Matt to try and escape from the correctional facility, it was another stupid decision. It was an act of boredom or opportunity. And the pre-sentence report adds another dimension, a belief or an attempt in some feeble way to point up the shortcomings of the correctional institution. I don't know what you were thinking at the time. I know what you're thinking presently, but I don't know what you were thinking at the time. And I find it difficult to contemplate that you felt escape would allow you to resume the freedom that you once enjoyed. Did you think that there would not be an all-out effort to bring you back into custody? I think it was another stupid decision, one that struck fear into the community that it didn't deserve, one that expended vast amounts of resources, money, and material, one that put hundreds of men and women in harm's way, and one that put you in the hospital with injuries you were still struggling with, one that killed a fellow inmate. And how would you term it other than stupid? You seem to indicate that you tried to escape to show the shortcomings of the correctional system, or as a protest for the treatment received from correctional officers. Aside from organizing an escape, I would ask, did you do anything to bring about a change in the facility by organizing or complaining or lodging complaints with regard to treatment or decisions made in the correctional facility? Maybe if you had expended the energy you expended in escaping to have reformed the program and conditions in the prison, it might have changed the outcome. It is all circumspect. You can attempt to elevate your actions to a cause, but I think it was simply another stupid decision. Sentencing you is anticlimactic, since life without parole, as they say, is what it is. I'm afraid rather perfunctory, since you are currently under an internal sentence, if you wish, of 6 years in solitary with loss of privilege. For acts, there are consequences, and unfortunately, you have had consequences aplenty. It is a sentence in this court that should be sentenced as a second felony offender. I don't know whether you filed or there has been filed a certificate of.
There has been, Your Honor, I believe.
David's eventual sentencing led him to taking his stint in Attica Prison. And though he's been interviewed and shared his insights about his venture outside the walls, it's not the last time that he's attempted to control his own fate. David has, in recent years, levied claims against Attica Prison, stating that the abuse and the threats he received from correctional officers there has led to an unsafe feeling in his contact with his then-fiancée, Fran Milanek, had been cut short. She claimed she innocently went to inspect a lump on David's groin during one of their visits. This was considered a sex act by the officials attending the visit. Now separated from his last threat of normalcy, David began to draw inward. More than that, though, he exercised a 5-month hunger strike in 2018, during which he lost upward of 30 pounds from his already slim frame. He thought that his food might be poisoned, and he claimed in a letter that he could feel his body cannibalizing itself. His mind suffered too, and it was only at the end of his strike that he eventually was taken from Attica and transferred to Wend, another prison that offers specific health facilities. The convincing that occurred to make this happen, though, was not considered a negotiation, which according to state policy would be a direct violation. Instead, the officials presiding over the decision simply stated that this was no different from the 60,000 other transfers that occur each year in the state. David and Ricky, killers and schemers alike, were found separately and each en route to Canada. Their plans, the people they used, and the dangers they faced all amounted to a short 3 weeks of being on the run. And when you're on the run, you're never free. The high prison walls that kept them were replaced by the inhospitable Highland environment, and the millions of scared New Yorkers that awaited their capture. Still, the darkness that was endured by the inmates after the prison's failures were inexcusable, and it goes to show that it's not always just the people behind bars that endanger lives. Sometimes it's also the ones we trust to keep the cell doors closed, the ones we trust to tuck away the nightmares of society. Thanks again for listening to Devil We Know. This is the two-part episode of our previous episode, concluding the narrative following the killers and escapees, David Sweat and Ricky Matt. If you're interested in Devil We Know, please join our Patreon to get ad-free episodes and possible early release episodes. Go to patreon.com/devilweknowpodcast. You can sign up for $1 a month. Again, thank you so much for listening. As always, I'm your host and producer, Aaron. This episode was researched by Sammy Taylor, and additional research was provided by David Wayne Young, the writer of this episode. Editing was done by Chase Gray. And as always, keep your head on a swivel.